You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Welcome to the Cosmic Pizza Podcast, the show of all sorts that sorts all by serving up a slice of life. What is your order? Ah, I see. The special it is. We'll be there to deliver ASAP. Cosmic Pizza Podcast Special Delivery.
Hello, and welcome to your special delivery of the Cosmic Pizza Podcast. I am Dan from the UK, and with me today is...
Paul from the UK.
And Sean from Canada.
And we are about to serve you the slice of life. And in today's episode...
Sorry about that. Don't know where that came from. Today's episode, we are going to be talking movies. Specifically, movies from the golden age of cinema, I think, 1950s, and some of our favourites. We're also going to go through some of the top movies as well from this decade. But it's Sean's baby. Sean came up with this idea. Do you want to talk a bit more about this, Sean, first before we get started?
I would love to, Dan. Thanks for that rousing introduction. You did a great job. You're almost like a movie trailer narrator yourself. That was fantastic.
I just got a peanut stuck in my back of my throat. I don't know what happened, but
That'll do it. That'll do it. Yeah. So anyway, we were talking about topic ideas for Cosmic Pizza episodes. And I was like, why don't we talk about our favorite films from each decade? Because we'll start in the 40s and we'll go all the way to the 2020s. And that'll be like 7 or 8 episodes right there that we can sprinkle throughout the next year and a half. And the boys here said, Sean, you're a freaking genius. And I said, you know what? I think you're right. So let's do that this coming week. And so we thought we'd start with the 40s. Unfortunately, we have not seen very many films from the 40s. So we're going to give maybe a shout out to a couple that we've seen, but we're going to focus on our top three favorite films of the 50s in this rousing episode of the Cosmic Pizza Podcast.
I feel inadequate here. You've got a movie trailer guy at the bottom there. Then you're right above him on my screen, you've got the radio show host, and then there's me.
Who are you?
I'm the audience. Where did you come from? I should have brought some popcorn. I mean,
if the listeners could see your background, that is a very impressive background. Right now, there's lots of posters for all the movies from this time period, and they look awesome.
They don't make posters like that anymore.
They don't, do they? I mean, there's some real classics on here. You know, unfortunately, I've got my camera mirrored, so I can't read them properly. But The Mummy, Dracula, and Godzilla, and all these, you know, amazing artworks that they've got on these posters. So I'm looking at it thinking I should really get some of these printed out and put them on the wall. They're really, really good.
Agreed. If I ever had the money for a proper cinema in the basement of my house with the reclining chairs and stuff, the walls would just be covered in vintage framed movie posters with spotlights on them, and it would be fantastic. Unfortunately, I don't have those funds right now, but one day.
Yeah, it's a good idea. That's I wonder, certainly my friend Lee, I mean, we've had on the show, he's certainly got a lot of old framed movie especially the 1950s and 60s style of artwork all around his house and in every room. You go to the toilet and think, my God, do I sit down and just read this for like the next hour or what? You know, it's amazing, absolutely amazing.
It is an aesthetic I like. I'm going to include a picture of this in the ad when we finally post the episode, but something I've got over here, fairly mint condition.
Movie Maker.
Nice. Yeah.
What's that then?
This is a mint condition. It's a board game called Movie Maker. the idea is that you have to buy a director, you have to buy your two lead actors, an actor and actress, you have to have a location, and then you have to license to make your movie. It's all set in the 50s era. So you've got all of the big like name directors, but they're just slightly off-brand name versions. So you've got Cecil B. DeMille is Cecil D. DeMille. You know, just slight changes. Wally Rubenstein is my favorite director to go for. And you basically have to collect Oscars by completing movies, and the person with the most Oscars at the end wins. It's a really simple game, but it takes hours because you can constantly like be tripped up by losing your license and losing directors to on-set squabbles and things like this. And it's a fantastic game. It's sort of a family heirloom. It's probably the only thing I've got that's a family heirloom. My grandfather bought it for £1.10, 10 shillings, I think, back then in the old money. And it is now worth just over £100. So saving that one, I think. It fits the aesthetic. It fits the mood. And it just put me in mind of today's episode.
Nice. Nice. I've never seen that game before. That's pretty unique, and the idea of it is very realistic as well. If you say, like, say on screen squabbles and on set squabbles and things, yeah, that's that sounds pretty true to life.
And in no way have I got the little Oscar figures out and like done my expectant speech in the bathroom or anything like that. No, I've never done that at all.
Yeah. Does one of the like cards that you turn over, does it say, yeah, you've just lost your director to a rather embarrassing indecent exposure charge, or, you know, or couch casting couch exposure or something? Yeah.
It was well ahead of the time. I mean, there's a hashtag release the Wallenstein cut, and it's amazing. It's crazy. It's a 4-hour movie. Crazy.
Yeah, you can play the short game or the long game. Yeah, the director's cut. Yeah.
Make 6 Blade Runners now. Go.
Excellent. I've never seen that before.
Yeah. There we go. But I understand you have a list for us, Paul.
I do have a list. And I went onto the old interwebs, as you do, and found a website that contained the top 100 films of the 1950s. And I thought, well, we'll see how we get on with that. I actually went through that list and picked out 40 films that I'll very quickly run through now that were either big at the time, made stars of the actors or leading actresses or whatever, films that you quote from to this day. What else we got? Classics that you should see or should know or definitely heard of, even if you haven't seen them. Right when we got to the end of it, I obviously showed you guys the list, and Dan said, "Well, I like this one," and it wasn't even in the top 100. I thought, how can it not be in the top 100? That's ridiculous. So we'll go. What I'll do is I'll read them out. You guys jump in if you want to mention anything about them, or if you have any particular memories of seeing these films or whatever. And these are in no particular. Well, I say no particular order. They are actually in reverse order because I've written them down that way. But I'm not going to number these in any way. The first one is a big one, The Ten Commandments, Charlton Heston.
Can't escape that. It's sort of
huge, yeah. Huge film.
Yep, definitely saw that.
The Curse of Frankenstein with Christopher Lee.
I'm not sure I've seen it.
Yeah, well, if you're going to watch any Frankenstein, you've got to watch the Christopher Lee one, I think.
Definitely.
Was that the beginning of sort of like the Hammer horror kind of, that was his upshot, wasn't it? That was where it started, and then it kind of carried on.
Exactly, yeah. This is like the golden days of horror in the 50s. A Star is Born, Judy Garland.
I think there's about 70 remakes of that show.
You're probably right. I think it's been on stage for a long time as well. East of Eden with James Dean. I think that was one of those, because he died so early, I think he made quite a lot of films that became classics later on because of his death rather than being big at the time, although he was big at the time. The Man Who Knew Too Much, James Stewart.
Yeah.
I'd love to see that.
Heard of it.
Godzilla, the original Godzilla.
I seem to have vague memories. I think I might have been drinking a lot at the time, so I don't really remember. They all kind of blend together after a while.
Yeah. I don't really watch the Godzilla films. I may have seen a bit of one. Big monster movies like that don't really interest me, I'm afraid. The Wild One, Marlon Brando, and I think that was the film that pretty much made him Again, I haven't seen it.
My wife is a huge Marlon Brando fan. She loves Streetcar, everything, all early Brando work.
War of the Worlds didn't have any big stars in it, but it was a big film, obviously, at the time.
Oh, that's in my honorable mentions. Same actually, here. It's a great Same one. Here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've not seen the original. Have I?
Oh, it's so good.
You haven't seen with the three eyeballs, the different colors, the technicolors, and you see the hand coming.
Pew, 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 pew.
And instead of tripods, they were sort of flying, and it's the sort of the sound effect. Okay.
No, I don't think I have seen it. Maybe I've not seen it.
Gave me nightmares.
No, okay. Yes, it gave a lot of people nightmares. Richard III, Laurence Olivier, which I think is regarded as a classic, and anything with Olivier in it is a classic. But Richard III is it?
That's I'm thinking Henry V. I think that it was sort of a big propaganda piece. I think I'm thinking wrong movie, wrong decade.
Okay, wrong king
as well.
The Lady Killers, Alec Guinness.
Never seen it
again. Nope. It's a film actually that if you listen to the Waffle On podcast, they have just done a review of it. So, and I haven't listened to it yet, but I believe it's another classic film. Not a lot goes on. It's all set in sort of like, you know, small rooms.
Love it.
It's, the writing is brilliant.
And they redid it, didn't they? They remade it with Tom Hanks, was it?
I believe so. Didn't see the remake or the original.
It doesn't surprise me that they've remade it, but I didn't know it was Tom Hanks. Cinderella, the old Disney classic there. Mm.
My mother's favourite.
Oh, dear.
I know.
The Thing from Another World.
Oh, the original Thing.
I must have seen it. I've seen so many cheesy sci-fi films from the 50s and 60s. I've probably seen it, but I can't remember all of them.
Harvey with James Stewart.
Nope.
Again, it's supposed to be a classic, you know, this big rabbit. Julius Caesar with Marlon Brando and John Gielgud.
Yeah, I think so.
Again, it's supposed to be a good one. Cat on the Hot Tin Roof with Paul Newman and Elizabeth Taylor.
Nope.
Can't say I've seen it.
No. One that I've got up here on my board, you see behind me, is Stalag 17.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've not seen it. I'm going to try and find that because I thought, it's a war movie. They're all locked in a prisoner of war camp and it's all the Great Escape type thing. It's actually a sort of comedy. Or it certainly brings up the lighter side of being in a prisoner of war camp. I don't know how you do that. So I need to see that to see what it was done or how it was done. Then another classic Christopher Lee film here, The Mummy.
I think I own it on one of those deluxe reissues, but I've never actually watched it. And I've had it for like 10 years or more. I buy DVDs and Blu-rays and I just never get around.
Then we've got To Catch a Thief. Cary Grant and is it Grace Kelly?
That sounds right, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah. So with Cary Grant, my grandmother used to be, she did quite a few jobs, but at one point she was a waitress I was going to ask my dad about this and I forgot to. And I think it might have been over in Liverpool she worked, or if it wasn't, it was over here. Cary Grant came over for whatever reason. I can't remember whether he was filming over here or whether he was just doing something over here. And she actually served him. A waitress. Yeah,
that's amazing.
She said that was her biggest claim to fame. She met Cary Grant, couldn't believe it. It's this massive film star. Because you can imagine in the 50s, you didn't get to see film stars because they didn't, especially American film stars, because they would have to have traveled over here, and that's a big thing to do. Very few films were made over here from American points of view. So to see a film star like that was a huge thing at the time. So to serve him his dinner. So yeah, she was a big fan of his. And next up is The Bandwagon with Fred Astaire. That's a big musical.
Never even heard of that one.
Wow, really? Well, Fred Astaire tends to dance a lot, so I think that was a musical.
I think, the big name people, I think he's one of the ones that I've seen the least of his films. Like, he's the one that everyone talks about, but I don't think I've actually sat down and watched a Fred Astaire flick.
Yeah, I mean, decent actor, but his dancing was phenomenal. You know, that's what he made his money with. Next one is Elizabeth Taylor and Cary Grant, Roman Holiday. I'm only aware of that because there used to be a band in the 1980s called Roman Holiday. So, Shane, Alan Ladd. Now, Shane was when I was at school, and we were about 15 or 16. In our English class, we read that book, or rather, my English teacher read that book, and we listened to her. And that was like a treat at the end of the day, if we'd all been good and done well, and you know, nobody had messed up, she would read the book. And she must have been in the, I assume, about a 40, late 40s or early 50s maybe. But she did all the voices and acted out all the people, which is, you know, considering she's a woman, she's doing all the male voices, so she's giving it the old gruff voice there, and then going, oh, the old high-pitched women's voice. Oh, it was amazing. Absolutely amazing. Oh. I've never read the book since.
Yeah, that's a teacher for you.
That she was bloody strict, but fair as well. Mm. I mean, you know, if you did things right, she was fine. If you got on the bad side of it, she could give you the cane, no problem. And she was only like relatively slight woman. I mean, you know, fearful there when she got a voice raised, though. She, you know, when she got angry, she could really get angry. Knew how to command a room of 30 kids, though.
You wouldn't like her when she's angry.
Oh, no. So Shane, I've yet to see, I think I've seen the film once, but I didn't really get it because I wasn't really into Westerns then. I might have to have another watch of that.
It's Jack Palance, isn't it? Jack Palance is also in that.
Well, quite possibly. I didn't look too far down the list.
I think he might be the bad guy in it. I only know it. I haven't seen the film.
Was that his era?
I only know it from Bill Hicks' stand-up routine where he talks about Shane and Jack Palance throwing a gun at a sheep herder's feet and daring him to pick it up so that he can shoot him and get away with it and say it was self-defense. And it's a whole comedy bit that he does for 5 minutes based on the Shane. And I've never seen the film.
I have to have a look at that. Another classic Western is High Noon with Gary Cooper and Grace Kelly.
Back to my dad, only watching war films, only watching Westerns. That is his diet. So he watched these, so I kind of absorbed them rather than sat and watched them properly.
Mm-hmm. And then the big one, A Night to Remember, which is obviously the Titanic disaster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was the 1950s version of it.
Yeah.
The next one up is From Here to Eternity with Burt Lancaster, which I believe, you know, another classic I've heard of, but I have no idea what it's about.
I know the scene.
Agreed. Yeah. Scene.
The kissing scene on the beach. That's all I know from it.
The African Queen, Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn. Classic.
Heard of it.
Yeah. Everybody's heard of it. Everybody quotes it. I can guarantee that somebody will have said some of these lines from it, you know, and played again, Sam. Mm-hmm. You know, well, that's
is that what that's from?
I think it is, yeah.
Okay.
I thought that was Casablanca, wasn't
is it?
I thought that was from Casablanca.
Oh, beg your pardon. No, it's Casablanca. Yeah, sorry, I'm getting my Bogarts mixed up. Yeah.
Don't cross the Bogarts.
Wait, aren't they the things under the bed that scare you?
Bogarts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Bogarts.
The Bogart man.
Same to you.
Yeah.
Next one up is Anatomy of a Murder, James Stewart. That again is another one I might just have to watch. Rio Bravo with Gary Cooper.
Another Western. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Another one, North by Northwest, which is one that the only reason I recognize it is because I think it must have been in a film. We used to have a film program over here called Film, whatever the year was at the time. So Film 81, Film 82, 92, 2002, whatever. And in fact, the music you will have heard at the beginning of this episode because it's a classic theme tune. And I think they used the part where the biplane comes flying down the, Cary Grant.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's right. And starts shooting at him in the course. So that's the only bit I know of it, and so I'm going to have to watch that to find out what it's all about.
He's also hanging off of Mount Rushmore, isn't he? At the end, there's like a bit where there's a tense moment where he's hanging off the side of the mountain, and there's like the bad guy standing over him. I seem to remember a scene like that. I might be getting again my Hitchcock's confused, but there you go. It's very dangerous to do that. But
then we have On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando again, another classic.
Yep.
The Searchers with John Wayne,
yeah,
which I believe is quite a big one for
heard
him.
Of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard of it mm-hmm. as well. Yeah, not seen it. Dial M for Murder with Grace Kelly.
Yes, I have seen that one.
And we mentioned this one before, Streetcar Named Desire, Marlon Brando again. Yeah. Now, 12 Angry Men with Henry Fonda. Ooh. That's one I've got to watch.
Isn't Gregory Peck in that?
That is
quite possibly. I just... was it Gregory Peck? I don't know. Yeah, I'd have to look. But that's another classic that I'll have to pick up because it's all based in the
mm-hmm.
back of the courtroom, isn't it? It's not
I think that's one I've seen more as a stage play than I have as the movie. I think I've watched the movie once or twice, not very much, but as a stage play, it's fantastic to see because it's just one room, 12 angry men, as it says, and that's all you have, and that's all you've got to go on.
That's designed for a play, isn't it? Yeah, it's just a stage, next one is Rebel Without a Cause, James Dean.
Not sure I've seen it.
No, I've not seen it either, but I think it was his sort of seminal piece, really. So Singing in the Rain, or rather, as everybody calls it, Singing in the Rain. It's not Singing in the Rain. It's, as we would say in Liverpool, Singing in the Rain. No G on
that. Yeah, that's Fred Astaire, right?
Yeah.
And one of the Hepburns, right?
Is it Fred Astaire? It's Gene Kelly.
Okay. I believe I've seen it, though. And from what I know, he was sick the entire time.
He had a high fever in the 40s, and he did the whole scene, one take, completely off his mind in pre-med drugs and all this kind of stuff, and still pulled it off flawlessly. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Make 'em Laugh was my audition piece for a school musical play as well. So that was the thing I did for the teacher to make sure that I could actually sing. So that was the piece I did. So I've got fond memories of that movie.
Very good. Just two more to go. Rear Window with, three to go actually. Rear Window with James Stewart.
That's a Hitchcock classic that I've never seen.
Exactly. Same. That's another one I've got to watch. Sunset Boulevard, Gloria Swanson. Heard of it.
Never seen it.
Mm-hmm. And the last one is Vertigo with James Stewart, which I have seen, which is a fantastic film.
Ah, yes. I saw that in film class in university.
We saw it in one of our last film nights that we had before we all got locked up.
Considering my surname is half of his, I really haven't watched much of Hitchcock's movies at all.
For shame.
No. Just never got into The Master of Suspense.
Oh, well. The Birds. Have you seen The Birds at least?
I think I have, but again, I don't think I was concentrating. There's birds. It's hurting people. I kind of get the point. Yeah, that's fine.
Psycho, Birds, Psycho Ruined,
I've
Vertigo.
Seen. Psycho I have seen.
All right, should we talk about the films that we actually enjoy?
Yeah, why not? Why not? Yeah,
right after this promo for another podcast on the ESO Network.
DragonCon 2021 is scheduled for Labor Day weekend, and whether it's an in-person event or once again goes virtual, the DragonCon Report podcast crew will cover the con right up to the big event.
So sit back with your bucket of rum, dragon's mead, apple pie, or whatever your beverage of choice, and tune in to the latest news, notes, interviews, discussions, and even a dragon tale or two on the DragonCon Report, a proud member of the ESO Network. Check us out at DragonConReport.com.
And we're back! That was a great promo. I can't wait to go listen to all their episodes.
Okay, Sean, how about we start with you? Shall we start with your honorable mention, first of all? Because
we could do
the
that.
Same, isn't it? We've got the same honorable mention, I think.
Yes, and before that, I would like to say that I'm a highfalutin, high-cultured man, and my favorite films are things like Anatomy of a Murder and A Streetcar Named Desire, and let's see what else we've got on the list here. Something called The Robe, and From Here to Eternity, and African Queen, and all those things. However, none of those are on my list because they're Oscar films or classics, and I just never bothered because, you know, it's just old movies from the 50s. Who cares? But there are movies from the 50s that I like, so I would probably like some of those. But yeah, let's talk about War of the Worlds, since we both have it on our honorable mention list.
Absolutely. I think the only reason it's on my honorable mentions and not in my top, well, what will be my top six, is just because it is so completely different to the book. And I love the book, and it's my favorite, one of my favorite books. And because it's so different, I can't give it that little bit more to really push it into the list. But it's iconic, that sound, that shrill noise as the heat ray is just about to start up, and the tentacled hand coming out at the end as it falls out to show the audience that, you know, the bugs, the bacteria have done their business with the Martians. Classic. You can't beat it.
No, you can't. And if we're going to reference a previous episode or maybe an upcoming episode, but we've already recorded it regardless, War of the Worlds was written by, was it H.G. Wells, Jules Verne?
Orson Welles.
Yeah. Or the other one that I keep mixing up too. George Orwell.
It's all well. It's fine. Yeah. We'll figure it out at some point.
Yeah, but no. War of the Worlds, 1953. Amazing. So much better than the 2005 Tom Cruise fiasco.
Hell yeah.
Well, I must admit, I've not seen either of them, but I can't imagine that the Tom Cruise one will be anywhere near as good as the original. Yeah. I'm a staunch fan of the LP that was brought out, the vinyl record.
Jeff Wayne.
Jeff Wayne. That musical, that to me is absolutely fantastic. The book is amazing. Mm-hmm. I read the book recently, last year or so, mm-hmm. 2 years ago. And yeah, it is really, really good. But I've not seen the film.
That's crazy. I have it on disc over here. You got to come visit and we can watch it.
It's a product of its time. It definitely fits into the whole B-movie way of doing things. You've got your classic scientist in a white coat. You've got your army soldiers who you shoot at it first thing that they see it. Mm-hmm. You've got there's the guy waving the flag who's the first to get blasted with the heat ray. There's the radio presenter who's saying, "I can't believe what I'm seeing here. It's like some giant metallic creature," and it just fits into that time period so well. It's indeed. So good. You can't knock it. It's brilliant.
No, it was almost in the top three, but there's a few other ones that I like more. Yeah, so
absolutely.
But yeah, War of the Worlds, classic. You got to watch it.
Paul, what would be your honorable mention?
My honorable mention would be, if I can find my list, it would be Ben-Hur. Because I remember it. Charlton Heston there.
Charlie Heston.
Charlie, yeah, good old Charlie boy. It's an epic film anyway, and I remember seeing it the first time because it was so long. I would sit down Saturday morning, and watching it and thinking, "Oh my god, this is going on for so long." But being gripped by it, the story is amazing anyway. It's you just follow this one guy all the way through the film, and it's his story, and he meets Jesus. I mean, it's incredible. The chariot race was phenomenal. It is an unbelievable piece of cinema, the way it was filmed. Some of the action actually happened. Guy was tossed over the front of the chariot. Really happened, so they kept it in the film. The way they filmed the Colosseum was to place a big model in front of the camera and film underneath it. So you had all the live action underneath it and the big Colosseum behind it, with rows and rows of people all painted on, obviously, bits of wood or whatever, and we're all on rods, and people behind the scenes will be pushing the rods up and down to make it look as though the crowds are going up. If you look closely, you'll see banks of people all rising up and coming down at the same time.
Nice.
There are rumours that there is a car parked in one of the scenes because they forgot to move the car out of the way, but I'm not too sure. I don't think I've ever seen that. I'd have to look somewhere.
Was it a DeLorean?
Really, really closely. I think it was a Mini, somebody had left a car in the scene. I haven't seen it, but the whole chariot scene is just phenomenal. It is a classic. It's an epic film. Nobody else but Charlton Heston, I don't think, could have done that at that time.
Very true.
Agreed. And I'm pretty sure that I saw it when I was a young teenager, but nothing I've seen in years, just like Ten Commandments and all his biblical epics.
Yeah. I mean, I owned it on video for a long time, and until obviously we got rid of videos and moved to DVDs. I've not since updated it to DVD. It's not a film I'd probably go back and buy if it's on the TV. I've seen it on TV a couple of times, but not really watched it, because it doesn't. You have to invest a bit of time in sitting down and watching it.
Shall we go through our proper lists by any chance? Yeah,
I think so.
Sure.
Why not?
And I'll just mention two more honorable mentions. Ooh, just because I wrote three down. So there was War of the Worlds. There was When Worlds Collide, which I believe is on the same disc, actually a multi-movie pack. And then Them as well, the one with the big radioactive ants.
Yes.
Yeah.
Them was a good film. I remember watching that one.
It was scary when I was a kid.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, I can't remember how they filmed it, but yes, it was. There was two films at the same time. I think one was with spiders or something, and then one was with ants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was all kinds of radioactive creatures back in the 50s.
It came from the deep. The attack of insert creature. That sort of thing. It's just the whole genre of just that.
Yeah, they came from above. They came from below.
came from the everywhere. Side, the angles. The hypotenuse.
Peekaboo.
Right. Well, that covers all of our honorable mentions. Let's move on to our top threes, as much as they are. We'll start with Sean. What is your number three pick?
My number three pick would probably be The Fly, starring Vincent Price. I saw that. Oof, I don't even remember when and how long ago it was that I had seen it. I know that I saw it when I was a really, really young kid, and it traumatized me for years. I've always been a Vincent Price fan. About 10 years ago, I bought it on Blu-ray and watched it. And if my remembrances are correct, when I saw it the first time, it was in black and white, but the version I got was colored. So I'm not sure how it was originally filmed, but the only thing I remembered was the end scene. Help me! And then I think he gets killed or squished or something. And it's really, really sad. And it affected me for years and years. And I never wanted to be miniaturized into a fly because they wouldn't know it was me. And then I would just get fly swatted. And then I watched it again, maybe 10 years, maybe less than that. And I was at a friend's house and her kid was there. And I think the kid was like maybe 3 at the time when we were watching it. It scared the bejesus out of her. But the effects are so cheesy, you know, like when I was a kid, it was great because we didn't have cool effects like we have now, but it was awesome. Have you guys seen The Fly? You must have seen the original.
A long time ago.
So it, whether it holds up, it doesn't. It doesn't hold up at all, but it's classically awesome and you have to watch
it. Oh yeah, definitely.
I think because it's been superseded by The Fly, the 80s version, the Jeff Goldblum version.
That's
hard.
Blasphemy.
I know. It kind of, because that's there and I like that film. I probably don't hold The Fly as high up, but I still enjoyed it. I still like going back to it and seeing it. Haven't seen it for a very long time though.
Paul? Yeah, I've not seen the newer version. I did watch the old one a while back, but it's so far back in my mind, I can't remember it.
The newer version's like 35 years old now.
I know. That's ridiculous, isn't it?
Which is crazy, but yeah. So that's my top three pick.
Ooh, pretty good.
Nice. Paul?
My top three, now here we go. It's hard to put these into an order really, but I'll go with Some Like It Hot. Tony Curtis, Jack Lemmon, Marilyn Monroe.
Can't think why you picked this movie. Can't think.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Is it the Mafia? The fact that, you know,
could be.
I like a bit of conservatory music? You know, do I a bit of oboe and cello sort of work? That'll be it. Yeah. To be fair, I'm not a big Marilyn Monroe fan, but she's not my type. She's blonde. She's dizzy. She's was always sort of too old for me because obviously when I was young, she was. Well, dead by then anyway, but she was, you know, she was a lot older than, so she wasn't the right age for me. You know, I was more interested in the stars of the 70s at the time, the Lindsay Wagners, et cetera, et cetera. As we mentioned on, what podcast was that we did that on, Sean? I can't remember now.
Oh, that might have been episode 195 of the Soulforge podcast, the childhood celebrity crush episode.
That's right. Yes, yeah. Well, we all said what crushes we had on who the celebrity crushes we had on in our early years, and I missed out quite a couple as well, which I was a bit surprised at. But anyway, so we all know that the story of this is, you know, the two guys are upset the mob and they have to disappear for a bit. They both play musical instruments, but they've got to run. They join up with a woman's all female jazz band, and the only way they're going to get away is to dress up as women. They join this band. They manage somehow to convince these women that they are women, which is all part of the comedy and the whole point of the film is that they manage to get away with it. Of course, Tony Curtis falls in love with the Marilyn Monroe character of Sugar. So he's trying to get off with her, and that's sort of the end of the film he does. But I think the best part of it is the fact that Jack Lemmon suddenly has this old fella, this old admiral that sort of fancies him, who's a proper real millionaire. And at the end of the movie, they're both sailing away on this boat. And I'm going to insert the scene here.
I call Mama. She was so happy she cried. She wants you to have her wedding gown. It's white lace.
Yeah, Osgood, I can't get married in your mother's dress. She and I, we are not built the same way.
We can have it altered.
Yeah, no, you don't. Osgood, I'm going to level with you. We can't get married at all.
Why not?
Well, in the first place, I'm not a natural blonde.
Doesn't matter.
I smoke. I smoke all the time.
I don't care.
Well, I have a terrible past. For 3 years now, I've been living with a saxophone player.
I forgive you.
I can never have children.
We can adopt some.
But you don't understand, Osgood. I'm a man.
Well, nobody's perfect.
Yeah, I've heard of that scene. I'm not sure I've ever seen the film, though.
Yeah, it's a cracking scene because what that says to me is this guy's not really bothered if this guy's a man. He loves the person. Mm-hmm. And in 1950s, yeah. To do that at the end of a film, although it's a comedy and it's right. Sort of played for the laughs, that's quite a bold bit of acting right at the end.
Subversive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I like the whole film. And I mentioned this to my sister a couple of days ago when we were on a Zoom call talking to each other. And I said, oh, my top three films are going to be these. And I said, something like It Hot. She goes, oh, God, I love that film. I love that film. And she quoted a few lines to us and all that. And the other thing that caught my eye is because my dad used to work for the oil company Shell. And, of course, Tony Curtis tries to pull himself off as this multimillionaire. And he says that he owns this oil company and they're sitting on a beach and she says, oh, which one? And he goes, well, and he's looking around trying to think, well, it's like this one. He goes, oh, Shell. Yeah, it's like, he pulls up this Shell thing. So whether it was product placement or whether it was just, they happen to be using the thing because they're on the beach, I don't know. But it was that instantly I went, oh, wow. He's saying he works with Shell. So yeah, good film. Dan.
Okay, well, my number three is actually my number five because Sean took two of my favorites. My top two are already taken. So
yeah, sorry about that.
I've got my 3 to 5. That's fine, Sean. It's fine. But yeah, it's number five pick. The reason it's in here is it's not because it's necessarily my favorite film, but because I've seen so few 1950s movies, this is the one that I probably watched the most. And it's only because it's on every Christmas, every bank holiday, at least once a year, it's playing somewhere on the TV. And it's... The Bridge on the River Kwai. It's Alec Guinness, one of his finest, in fact, his finest piece, because he actually won an Oscar for it. And it's about a POW camp in Japan that is forcing these paratroopers from the Allies to build a bridge so that they can access their rail networks and bring in supplies far easier than they ever could on the Kwai. It's sort of loosely based on a real event. It's not an actual bridge that was built. That was built apparently 800 miles down the river, but it's about this story of a British commander who is kind of going along with it and actually is getting quite prideful about this bridge that he's building, not thinking that he is building it for the enemy to kill his comrades, his fellow comrades in the British Army. And it's a piece about how far does he go to play along? And how much does the commandant in charge of the POW campus sort of let him get away with certain things? It's a, there's no set enemy. There is the Japanese. There are people in place who are pushing him to do things. So he's not the bad guy as such. It's a wonderfully complex film. It's there's a love interest story, which apparently the producers wanted to put in because there wasn't enough sex and interest and love coming in. So they wanted to shoehorn in a nice love story. So the American in it, the William Holden, he has a whole love story going on. But Alec Guinness is the reason you're watching this film, because his performance is just fantastic. And apparently he hated it. He actually didn't think that he was doing very well. And it wasn't until the film was almost finished, they sent a reel of the film over to his house. They sat down and the director said, right, how is everything? And apparently the family and Alec just left the room. They had no reaction. They didn't say anything. And Alec only came back a couple of days later to say, actually, thank you so much. I think I've really enjoyed this. I did a lot better than I thought I was. And yet he's won an Oscar. He's one of the most self-doubting actors you could possibly think of. And it really shows. And it's one of my favorites.
Now, I think I may have seen it. Is there a scene like with a lagoon and a woman in a bikini?
Yes. Okay. There's lots of lagoons and bikinis and sudding yourself up in the river as they're cleaning.
Yeah, oh, yes. I have a vague recollection. I'm not sure if I've seen it all or if I've just seen that scene in like things I've watched and it referenced it or not. But the one thing I do know about the film, the book was written by the same guy who wrote the book of the Planet of the Apes.
Yes, that's it.
That's all I know.
That's it. That's fair enough. Yeah, I think the other one with the getting washed in the river is the boobs over the river choir, but I think that's the porno version, so that's fine.
Oh yeah, classic again.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, the only thing I have watched the river choir, but unfortunately, the only bit I can remember is the very last, you know, the ending of it.
Yeah, he leans over and has to. Detonate. Sorry, spoilers for a 70-year-old film, but detonates the bridge, destroys it because he realizes he's gone too far. He's helped the enemy too much. But the bridge itself was it cost $250,000 to build, and they built it before they'd even cast everyone in the movie. They knew they were going to make it, so they built the whole bridge and had it all ready to go, only to blow it up in spectacular CinemaScope, which was the big selling point for this film as well.
Excellent. I need to see it again, I think, or maybe for the first time. I'm not sure. I can't remember.
Well worth it. Right, Sean, should we go for your number two pick?
Let's do it. And since it's also on your list, why don't I get you to help me about with this a little bit? It is the 1951 classic directed by the director of Star Trek, the motion picture, Robert Wise, The Day the Earth Stood Still. What can I say about this film? It's black and white. It's got Gort the robot. The man comes to the Earth to make humanity stop fighting with each other, because if they don't, well, then the alien galactic federation is either going to quarantine the planet or blow it up or something. It's been quite a while since I've seen it. I've seen it lots, but not recently. The thing to control the robot is, of course, a classic three-word line.
Gort, Matu, Narada, Nikto. Latu, Narada, Nikto.
Parodied in 1992's Army of Darkness. Klaatu, Barata, necktie, neckerchief, Nick 2. You guys must have seen that classic Army of Darkness, Bruce Campbell film.
Oh, yes.
No.
Yes. And you have it? No. Paul?
It is what?
You have a DVD
so daft,
store.
So silly. It's
five
so
minutes down the road from you, and you've not seen these things.
No, that's right.
Tell me you've seen The Day the Earth Stood Still.
I have not seen The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Oh, my goodness. Dan, talk to me about this film, how good it is.
I mean, we've mentioned one of the films we're going to talk about on another episode, Forbidden Planet being a proto Star Trek. You can definitely see The Earth Stood Still as another proto Star Trek. The message of peace, mm-hmm. give away your weapons, destroy your weapons, or I'll destroy them for you. This whole idea that you shouldn't be killing each other, that you should be working together, just and all the tropes as well. You've got the damsel in distress being carried away by the robot as she's passed out and fainted. and the UFO that lands down in the, is it by the White House?
I think so. I think so.
Yeah. Government building. We'll just say government
building. Yes, generic government building.
Just that classic look of it lowers down, but then you've got the cylinder that comes down to lower it in, mm-hmm. and the platform. Just perfect. And silver. Everything is in silver because that's what space is all about.
It's futuristic. And
absolutely.
And Gort, the robot, the actor was an unknown. I think he was a waiter or something. I can't remember the details, but he was like 7 foot something. He was very frail. And they had to make two versions of the suit because they didn't want to have any seams showing because it's a futuristic robot. So there was one where the seam was in the front and another where the seam was in the back. So every time they filmed them, they just put on a different suit for the guy. So that way it looked like it was futuristic and no seams, and it's sci-fi. These guys are from space. It's awesome. Paul, you got to see it.
That makes it a classic. There's no knobs and dials. Like, there's nothing whirring. It's not like Robbie the robot from the Forbidden Planet. It's a simple, just clean, flat design. And it can freak you out. But yeah, Gort is just, it's an unnerving. It's a very unusual design for the time period. Again, another film where they're doing something very odd. And yeah, perfect.
Yeah, and you got to see it, Paul. It's a classic. I've been meaning to watch it again the last few years, and I just haven't got around to it again. But yeah, it's something everybody who's a sci-fi fan must see for their education.
You don't need to see the Keanu Reeves remake.
Oh my goodness. Was it Keanu Reeves or Nick Cage? I think it was Keanu Reeves. It was horrible. I was so disappointed. It was garbage.
There's so many things they could have done, and they didn't. And
it was a dumpster fire. Yeah. Like, if you're going to remake something, at least improve upon the original. Don't make stinking garbage.
Right, Paul, should we do your second one then?
Now, this is where it gets awkward, because my second one is also my first one, and my first one's my second one. I can't place them into an order one above the other. They are so different films. They really are. And so I was looking down at my list and thinking, well, which one have I seen the most of? And I think I've seen them both the same amount of times. So let's go with The Seven Samurai. The classic.
Good pick.
Yeah, the Akira Kurosawa, if I could say that word, Kurosawa.
It's hard to say. And that was actually one of my honorable mentions as well. I had to watch it in film class. I've only seen it once. And they made a remake of it, right, in Hollywood?
They have made many remakes of it. It's basically The Seven Samurai is the same as The Magnificent Seven. Or rather, the other way around. It's almost scene for scene.
Yes.
If you look at the 1970s, I think it was, Magnificent Seven, mm-hmm. 70s, 60s, 70s, yeah. And everybody. It is pretty much the same, like I say, scene for scene. All the characters are the same. All of the shots are the same. The idea is the same. You know, so the, mm-hmm. yeah, what one guy recruits six others to help him defend a village of poor people who have 40 bandits attacking them at a certain time. And the thing that the reason I like this, and I think it's as good as, well, the Magnificent Seven is as good as The Seven Samurai, but The Seven Samurai for me has it because A, it was filmed in the 50s, B, it was sword fighting and not gun fighting. And at the time, mm-hmm. I was really big into martial arts. I was trying to do Aikido at the time. And so obviously, and my uncle's a big, he's been doing Aikido for many years. And he sort of said, oh, you need to see these two films. The one was The Seven Samurai. The other is Yojimbo, both with Toshiro Mifune as one of the characters, who is a phenomenal actor. Probably the best Japanese actor to come out of Japan for many, many years. And I just loved it. I loved the sword play. It's all, of course, in Japanese, so it's all subtitled.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it a little bit hard to watch because I'm a bit slow reading the subtitles. But and of course, if you read the subtitles, you can't see what's going on in the screen.
That's always the worst part.
Yeah, but after a while, you sort of get to it, and you don't really need that. You can see what's going on. Half the time, you don't need the subtitles. It's only for the scenes that everybody's in a room together that you might need to know, understand what's going on. But yeah, it is a phenomenal film. It's so well made. It's all in black and white, but it's so well lit and so well made and so well filmed.
Oh yeah,
the horse riders will come in at full belt, and then all the samurais will start attacking them, and all. It's just the action sequences are incredible. Really, really well done, and it's no wonder that it has been copied so many times. It is your cowboy walks into town and saves the town. I mean, that's every Western was made on that basis. So every Clint Eastwood film's been made on that basis.
Mm-hmm. And Kurosawa did everything first. That's the beauty of it.
Yeah, that's right. Everybody copied him because he did so many good films. In fact, going through this list, I found another one that I need to add to my list and see, because I hadn't seen it before. Again, with Kurosawa and Mifune, made quite a few films together. And when you get those two together, you get fabulous storytelling and fabulous
classics. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Good pick. Yeah. Excellent.
I think, didn't George Lucas sort of say that the Seven Samurai was the basis for the Jedi and the design, or the idea, the honor code? And
well, he stole his ideas from everywhere. Mm.
Well, true. Very true. No. In fact, there's something coming up in one of my picks that will be one of those things as well.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Well, let's pick your second.
Yes, let's hear your second then, Dan.
It's not that film. My film, my last film will be the Star Wars link, but the second film is Journey to the Center of the Earth with James Mason.
James Mason.
Everybody's got a James Mason. There isn't actually a lot I can tell you about behind the scenes, because going through IMDb, trying to trawl this movie, there isn't actually a lot of behind the scenes trivia that's been saved about the film. But it was one of those movies that we recorded on VHS and I just watched over and over and over again for no explicable reason. I was into dinosaurs at the time, but the dinosaurs in this movie don't look anything like the dinosaurs that I had as my toys, because they're chameleons and rhinoceros lizards with their little horns glued on top of them to make them look a bit more menacing. You've got the bad CGI of the characters reacting to these dinosaurs in the background, and there's the quite clear cut-out line that they've made. I can tell you the lava from the center of the Earth was actually made of oatmeal using the same techniques as the time machine from 1960, and that was in the tagline. That was actually in the trailer.
Oh yeah.
When they released the movie, because the movie came out in 1959 before Time Machine, but by the time it came to the UK, it was after the Time Machine's release. So the trailer came out and actually made out this, the Time Machine's effects are being used in this new brand new movie, which was made 2 years ago. So they're using the same techniques and everything like that. So my favorite film from the 60s, prompting our next episode, The Time Machine.
Oh,
there's effects being
mine
used
too.
In this one as well.
Oh man, I think we're the same person, Dan.
Gonna have to duke it out for that one.
I think
there's no way I'm relinquishing
that. Depending on what the other films are, it could well be in my top three as well.
But it was filmed in Iceland as well. So that's the other trivia fact that I have for you. But there's not much to go on with this movie.
That's okay. I may or may not have seen it. I can't remember. Probably, though. Probably when I was a little kid, just watching TV on Saturday afternoon.
There's a fantastic trailer on IMDb, which was narrated by James Mason, talking about all the fantastic effects and all the things you're going to get to see. And he was talking about himself, talking about the character, then talking as the character.
It's unthinkable, but it must be true. A man took some tools and went where no human being had ever set foot, alone. Went into the interior of the earth.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is James Mason. Come along with Pat Boone and me, Arlene Dahl, Diane Baker, and Gertrude the Duck, and discover sights and sounds and wonders no living man has ever witnessed before, filmed in the incomparable magic of CinemaScope.
A little bit like a podcast I've been listening to called the Temple Trek podcast. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
I have heard of that, actually. It's really, really good.
It is very good. It is.
Crazy.
It's a lunatic who's doing it, but yeah.
I know. Yeah, he talks about himself. He talks about the character. He is the character. It's all over the place. Yeah.
Very meta.
But it's exactly the same as that trailer. Yeah. Crazy. Okay, all right. Let's move on to your top pick, Sean.
Okay, I think you gave it away earlier. And it's also one of your tops. Of course, it is Forbidden Planet from 1956, starring Walter Pidgeon, Leslie Nielsen, and Francis. And introducing Robbie the Robot from... Welcome to Altair 4, gentlemen. And Oh my goodness. Oh, I don't know when the first time I saw this was. Probably when I was like 20. Yeah, probably university. Late nights on the sci-fi channel, and or maybe it was in class, because it's actually based on Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew, and since I'm an English major, they would have talked about it. And it's amazing. It's the first film to have an entirely electronic score. The music is completely haunting, and the guts of the planet, of the machines that the Krell built, is actually, Paul, you must know this, JMS from Babylon 5 actually copied it and put it on Epsilon 3, the planet that Babylon 5 orbits.
Right. No, I did not know that. There you go.
So you've never seen this film either?
No, not seen this film either. It's now on my list. Oh. But okay, so Sean, behind me on this, in this backdrop that I've got, we have the Day the Earth Stood Still, and with a poster for that, with a large robot, domed head, holding a woman, and walking across a landscape.
Yes.
The Forbidden Planet has a large robot with a domed head holding a woman draped across his arms walking across a landscape. Tell me what the difference in these two films are.
Actually, I don't think those are actually scenes from either of those movies. It's just how the people who made movie posters in the 50s thought they would attract viewers. Oh, look, it's a robot holding a scared woman. I think I'm going to go see that film because I like half-naked ladies and robots, so this must be a classic film.
It's made perfectly for you then, wasn't it?
Yes, a little bit before my time. This movie came out in 56. I was born in 76 and probably saw it 20 years after that, but I bought it on on DVD when DVDs first came out, and then when the 50th anniversary edition came out, I bought it again because it was a special collector's a metal tin case. It had a little figure of Robbie the robot. It had all kinds of lobby cards. It had The Invisible Boy, which was the second film or TV show that Robbie the robot showed up in, because Robbie the robot showed up in all kinds of pop culture. He's in Cherry 2000 from 1987. I think he was in an episode of Big Bang Theory. He's just been everywhere all the time.
Welcome to Altair 4, gentlemen. I am to transport you to the residence. If you do not speak English, I am at your disposal with 187 other languages along with their various dialects and sub-tongues.
Colloquial English will do fine, thank you. This is no offense, but you are a robot, aren't you?
That is correct, sir. For your convenience, I am monitored to respond to the name Robbie.
And the film is amazing. The guy who plays Dr. Morbius, what an actor. He reminds me of the leader of the Triskelions in Gamesters of Triskelion, the Master Thrall. Same kind of guy, you know, and... I don't know, Dan, take it away, because
you can hear it in his voice, can't you, Dan, that just how excited he is about this film.
Yeah, it is. It's just one of those films that when you watched it, you just knew that you're going to love this movie, because you can see Star Trek coming out of it. You can see all the groundwork for all of the sci-fi that came out of it, where Flash Gordon had rockets and it was all about the serialization and just playing up the action, things like this. This was the one that was going to take it seriously. This was the one that was going to elevate it from things like The Earth Stood Still and Them and the B movies and just push it one step further, take it really seriously. It helps being based on a Shakespeare play, being the Tempest, where they're crushed up against the ship, and Prospero is the wizard who is controlling this area. They come across a scientist who is controlling an entire planet. And there's a monster and there's things and they have to come together and they have to solve the problem. It's a classic for a reason. It you base it on Shakespeare, you take it further. It's spawned a whole cult classic for it as well. There's musicals about it. There's The Return to the Forbidden Planet, which is the sequel.
There was a sequel?
The sequel musical stage play, which is all 1950s music, and it is fantastic. And if you ever get a chance to see it, it used to do a tour around the UK all the time, but I don't see it very much anymore.
Okay.
But it's so good. And yeah, Robbie the robot comes on stage, everything.
So quotable. Yeah. And you said it was based on The Tempest, not Taming of the Shrew?
The Tempest, but yeah, because the Bellerophon is the same name of the ship.
Ah, okay. See, for an English major, I don't know my Shakespeare that well, but since you're British and so was he, that makes a lot of sense.
Playing the British card. There we go.
There you go. And speaking of its influence on Star Trek, I remember the first time I watched it, it blew my mind. And I'm like, that friggin' Roddenberry, that's where he stole all his ideas from. Because there's a scene where I think they've already landed on the planet and they're going through decontamination procedures and they step into a room that looks like a transporter beam, but it's just taking away their microbes or something, but it looks like the transporter. And that's, I'm sure, where Roddenberry got his idea for the transporter.
Absolutely.
And then there's the Id monster. There's the Krell. There's Altera, his daughter. Oh, Paul, go pick it up tomorrow.
As soon as he opens, I'm there.
Yeah, it surprises me that they haven't tried to redo it.
Well, Michael's JMS was going to do a trilogy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he never did get around to it. Maybe it will happen one day. I'd love to see an updated version of this, but it never takes away from the appeal of the classic. Probably in my top five favorite films of all time, Forbidden Planet.
Okay, then. Well, Paul, should we go to yours?
Yes. Okay, then. So my top film of the 1950s is actually one of my favorite films of all time. I can't remember the first time I saw it, but it must have been in the 80s or late 80s or somewhere on there. Watched it and I thought it was absolutely amazing. It's called The Quiet Man with John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara, directed by John Ford. Obviously, John Ford and John Wayne normally do the Westerns, but they decided to try something a little bit different. This was the sort of first time that John Wayne had done something that wasn't a Western. And he basically, he's an American, an Irish-American, and he has moved back to Ireland to try and buy the old family home in the middle of Innisfree, which is a made-up place in Ireland.
A little place across the brook, that humble cottage, who owns it now?
For the widow to learn, not that she lives there.
Think she'd sell it?
Who doubt it?
Don't bet on it, because I'm buying it.
Now, why would a Yankee from Pittsburgh want to buy it?
I'll tell you why, Micheline O'Flynn, young, small Michael Flynn, who used to wipe my runny nose when I was a kid. Because I'm Sean Thornton, and I was born in that little cottage over there. And I've come home, and home I'm going to stay.
He gets there, he moves into the house, and of course, naturally, everybody's trying to work out who's got the house, who is it? And they realise it's obviously a son of the original owners and all this. And they remember him when he was a young kid, and there's a lot of people who remember him. While he's there, he bumps into a rather feisty, red-headed, gorgeous-looking woman in Maureen O'Hara. And of course, he falls in love with her, and he wants to take her out on a date and see her. But of course, this is Ireland, based in the sort of early 1900s, when traditions were all the rage then. And you cannot just go up to a woman and say, fancy a drink. You have to speak to the parents. You have to speak to other relatives, at least. There's a certain courting ritual you have to go through. So, of course, he turns up, asks her out. She says, "Oh, I can't do it. I can't even speak to you. He then has to go and ask the permission of, as it turns out, not her father, as it should have been, because he was certainly of the age, but her brother, who's a big, big 6'3". Proper Irishman, built like a brick outhouse. He's a real, real big guy. Played by Victor McLaughlin, and this is Will Danaher. He's of the family Danaher. So that she's there, the cook and the cleaner for the whole family, and he's there as the elder man, running this farm and what have you. Of course, he totally flatly says, "No, you cannot go out with my daughter at all, sister at all, blah, blah, blah." And then John Wayne has to try and work out a way of seeing her. And he enlists the help of a couple of villagers who are on his side. And it all comes to a head where they trick Will Danaher into sort of thinking that where another woman fancies him. So it sort of distracts him a bit while John Wayne manages to go out with Maureen O'Hara. where they have to go out with like half the village as chaperones to make sure that everything is fine. They can't touch each other. They have to stand so far apart when they're walking. Of course, they get so far along this village lane, they spot a couple of bikes and they're off on the bikes. You know, they're riding across the thing. They're trying, you know, kissing the cuddle and all this type of thing, which is all fantastic. But then, of course, Will Danaher finds out that John Wayne wants to marry his sister. And of course, there's a dowry involved, and the brother owns the dowry. He's not going to give it to her. And John Wayne says, I don't want it. I'm not interested in it. She then goes mad saying, I can support myself. I have this dowry. What's wrong with me? And all this type of thing. A big argument. Comes to this head where they have this fight. Or he says, right, I'm going to fight you. If you think you can take my sister away, I'm going to fight you. And John Wayne said, no way am I going to fight you. And it turns out that when he was in America, John Wayne was a boxer. And he used to, so he was a pretty good fighter. He could handle himself, not a problem. Unfortunately, there was an accident in one of his fights. And he hit a guy, he went down, and he was killed. So he stopped right away. He says, I'm not fighting ever again. Never, ever going to fight again. So he moved to Ireland to sort of get away from it, all the headlines and all that. And one of the priests recognizes him from that and says, well, if you don't want to fight him, you don't want to fight him, but you're going to have to do something. You're going to have to go up against him. Otherwise, you're not going to get his respect. You're not going to get the dowry. You're not going to get the woman. So he goes up to the guy. He says, okay, I'll accept your dowry. So he gets the dowry and he sort of throws it away. He says, right, okay. We don't need that. There you go. So, of course, it's a big argument. Next minute, the fists are swinging. Danaher's fighting, John Wayne, and there's a scrap. On screen time, 5 minutes, one-on-one, across the village. They're punching each other into streams. They're, running after each other. They get into a pub. They're fighting. And one of the guys going, no fighting in the pub. Can't fight in the pub. So they sort of stop for a bit. And all right, okay. He says, well, look, he says, I'll buy you a drink then. He goes, I got it. He says, keep your money. I'll buy the drinks. He says, no, you keep your money. I'll buy the drinks. So they're arguing over the drinks. And next minute, boom, they're off again. And, they're fighting the way through the village again. Eventually, it all sort of works out and it sorts itself out. And they all agree in the end that they're going to get married and they buy the house. And she moves into the house with them and all that. And it's of its time in the sense of it's the 50s. But also set further back in the early 1900s, it means that a lot of people are looking at it now and going, bloody hell, it's sexist. Well, of course it is. He's the man, not just a man. He's a big man as well. So, and the Irish guy is a big Irish guy. They're both male. They're both strong. And she's the sister of the household they've got. So naturally, she's the one cooking, washing, providing for the family and all in that respect. That was the sign of the times. There was a potato famine on at the time where the British held back a lot of supplies of food and stuff. The only thing they could eat was potatoes. So that's what they have a meal. Mm-hmm. And she's going, have more potatoes. Just a big stack of potatoes on the table. That's all they could eat in the early 1900s. It was a time of famine. The IRA are mentioned. There's a couple of guys there who are in the IRA. Now, this is a little bit before they start attacking the English later on in the century. But but they still obviously hate the English and want to try and get the English out of Ireland and all that. So that's mentioned. It's not an issue. I watched the thing and I thought, yes, I understand it's a part of the time that, of when that was. What the IRA then became on to be was in the 70s was horrific. But, this is more of its time. So I don't have any problem with the way people are portrayed, the way that the Irish, there's no, none that I can see racism towards the Irish. They are all playing people that are the right people. There's, the accents are all correct because most of the people are played by Irishmen. There was a lot of locals were brought in, to speak Gaelic in the background of scenes and things. It is the only film, Hollywood film that, has Gaelic in it that is spoken in it, so it's genuinely a good historical piece and a good romp. And one of the reasons I liked it was the 5 minute fight scene. It's hilarious.
Here's where we let you down and say we've never seen it.
Never seen it, never heard of it, but it sounds like something we need to watch.
It is. It's one of John Wayne's best films. I mean, you can watch as many of the westerns as you like, and he does westerns really well. This was totally different, and it worked perfectly. He didn't look at it and go, oh, right, okay, well, he's not doing too well. Like the, later on in life when he did a police, he was a cop, wasn't he? That didn't work so well, but this, for some reason, it just works really, really well.
Okay, well, we're going to move on to my final pick, and it's the movie that I watch all the time, anytime it's on. It's popped up in my Facebook feeds more time than I care to mention, because I constantly love watching this movie, and it is The Dam Busters. The Dam Busters is sort of based on an actual historical event, but with some apocryphal bits thrown in. It tells the story of the attack on the Ruhr bridges. The Germans are building these bridges so they can move their munitions and further the war effort. But it's caked. It is covered in anti-aircraft guns. So there's no way of directly attacking from above. They have to engineer a new solution. And hey presto, they come up with the bouncing bomb, where they will release it by flying very low, below the anti-aircraft guns, release the bomb, and it will bounce, skim across the water like a stone on a pond, and hit the target, roll down, and explode. Fantastic story. It's, like I say, a bit apocryphal. There are real-world elements in it, but there are some of the stories that are made up that have come along with the legend of it, such as the time where they figure out how to fly the planes lower. The lead captain realizes when he goes to a theater how the spotlights always line up on the main actress every single time, and he can use that to sort of work out his bearings and his measurements. Completely apocryphal, not a real thing. It's actually based on a technology that was made a year before the assault. But it's all true. They did attack the Ruhr bridges. It was successful. Not as important a victory for the British Allied forces as they like to make out, more of a morale booster than anything else, as most of the damage that was inflicted was repaired within about a month after the attack. But still, one of my favorite movies and well worth a watch.
Yeah, and that's something that I've ever seen, but I remember when I was a young boy, my grandfather told me all about it. And so it's definitely on the long list of things to watch one day, perhaps, maybe, if time allows.
Oh, I'm just thinking, actually, you've got Nimoy there on you, who's a black dog. There's a black dog in this movie. Maybe it will appeal to him. Maybe you can show it to him.
It just might. I don't know. He's only 2 months old. He's a teacup Yorkie named Nimoy after Leonard Nimoy Spock. But yeah, he likes to watch things on my phone, so he might like the movie.
I mean, the black dog in this one does have an N-word for a name, but I can't say it on the podcast, otherwise we'll get burnt.
Okay.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
I had actually blanked that out of my memory. Yes, I knew there was one World War II film that had the dog, unfortunately, but yes.
Yeah, that was actually blocked out in the American release. They weren't allowed to say that for obvious reasons.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, but that was genuinely the actual dog as well. They brought the real dog, who was the mascot, into the film because he was still alive at the point.
So that's amazing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll have to check it out one day.
Isn't that the film though with the dodgy effects? Because it's obviously early 50s film on a budget. You know, it's a British film. Some of the aircraft models were a little bit dodgy, like almost like Thunderbirds.
Is this the one that I've heard about? That when the bomb explodes, the explosion is actually hand drawn. It's not a real explosion. Is that the one?
You have. It's almost like you've talked to someone about this movie a lot.
Yeah, recently.
You know what happened? We had a really in depth discussion about this, but we forgot to hit record, so we're just repeating ourselves.
Which is why it sounds as though we're rushing through this portion of the podcast, because we all want to get to bed.
That's it, exactly.
Some pillock called Fairbob went and forgot to sort of press record button. And
we would have gotten away with it too, if it wasn't for Sean and his damn dog.
pesky, flipping Thelma and Scooby Doo over there. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that was a great show, gentlemen.
That was a great show.
If I'm ever able to travel once the COVID restrictions have been lifted, I'm going to come and visit you guys over there in the UK, and we're going to have some epic film nights.
We certainly are. Definitely.
Yeah. And we'll play Movie Maker whilst we're doing it as well.
Excellent.
So our special is gone. The grease in the box is cold, and we hope you are full to the brim. So join us for more slices of life in the next special delivery of the Cosmic Pizza Podcast.
That was perfect. Like Winston Churchill on helium.
Who's that? What are they doing?
Never in an age of cosmic pizza podcasting has there ever been.
I'd say you woke up the dog, but he can't hear you because I got the headphones on.
Today, please leave a tip at the door by subscribing for future deliveries, rate and review our service, and we hope you come back for more helpings next time. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr and TikTok by searching for the Cosmic Pizza Podcast. If you would like to send us an MP3 file, you can email us on cosmicpizzapodcast@hotmail.com, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the Cosmic Pizza Podcast.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping at the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.